Jeffrey Holland is a senior apostle for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the theme of his speech at BYU on Monday was described in promotional material with a scripture in the Book of Mormon for believers to knit their hearts together in unity.
At a university, there will always be a healthy debate regarding a whole syllabus full of issues. But until we all come to the unity of the faith and have grown to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, our next best achievement will be to stay in harmony with the Lord's anointed, those whom He has designated to declare church doctrine and to guide Brigham Young University as its trustees.
For those not familiar with the lingo, what Holland means by staying in harmony with the Lord's anointed is staying in harmony with church leaders, leaders who, as he said, have declared church doctrine. Now, what he was getting at and would get to soon in the speech was a very particular doctrine, a position the church, like many other conservative Christian religions, hold, that intimate relationships between LGBTQ people are forbidden. Same-sex marriage goes against God's law. It's sin. Now, to be fair, the LDS Church has evolved on this issue. After years of declaring same-sex orientation a choice, after supporting conversion therapy, describing gay people as predators, they've come to this position where you can be gay. You can come to church. You can hold callings. You just can't be gay, if you know what I mean. You can't have sex. The part of Holland's speech, though, that may have gotten the most attention was the part where he said that if maintaining that policy cost the church and the school professional certifications and affiliations, well, so be it. We'll get back to Holland's speech here in a moment, but it's important to see where this unwillingness to budge fits in church history, because this is not the first time a leader at BYU tried to hold the line. The historian Matt Harris at Colorado State University, Pueblo, told us this week that something similar happened years ago because of the church's notorious policy of keeping black people from the priesthood.
I'm going to start today with April of 1968. Ernest Wilkinson, who's been the BYU president since 1951, received a letter in the mail stating that BYU was going to be the subject of a federal investigation to look into the recruitment and hiring practices of BYU vis-a-vis its black student and faculty population. And April of 1968 is a critical month because a week after Wilkinson received this letter, he also received word that student athletes at the University of Texas, El Paso were going to boycott a track event with BYU athletes. So these two events caused Wilkinson a lot of sleepless nights. So Wilkinson in April of 1968 was given this letter stating that by May of 1968, a month later, that the Department of Justice would send a three-person review team to the campus to figure out if BYU is in compliance. And not surprisingly, Wilkinson panics because he knows that the university does not want black students at the school. And they fear black sexuality. Like a lot of other universities, a lot of other public institutions at the time that were anti-interracial marriage, they feared that if you have black students and white students going to school together, they feared that ultimately it would lead to dating and then marriage. So Wilkinson contacts the Board of Trustees, the apostles who, in the first presidency, the men who run the church, and they oversee BYU. They establish policies and procedures for BYU, and he explains to them what's going on. Now, the church, of course, is a very hierarchical institution, and they pride themselves on not being told what to do from government agencies or members, for that matter. And now they're being told what to do, and they're not happy about it. And Harold Lee, who was the most dominant apostle in the 1940s and 50s, he was a brilliant administrator. He had a quick temper. He had a sharpened pencil. He was always looking at charts and graphs and budgets and so forth. And during a board meeting, when Wilkinson had explained to him what was going on with this federal investigation, Lee just said, "I don't give a damn about federal authorities. We'll give up our accreditation if we have to." Now, Wilkinson, who's conservative, theologically and politically like Lee, He understands that you cannot give up your accreditation and expect to have a legitimate university. So this puts Wilkinson in a huge pickle, because Wilkinson knows that the board will not win this fight if it's going to have an accredited institution. And so his task is to straddle a very, very careful line, convincing the board to somehow concede some issues with the Department of Justice, while also trying to protect their fear about interracial dating and marriage. And so in November of 1969, things sort of reach a crescendo when the government threatens to take away the accreditation. And Wilkinson knows that this is significant. This would be a fatal blow to the university that he's trying to build. And so in November of 1969, Lee backs off. By the late 1960s and into the early 1970s, they started to recruit both black students and faculty. The elephant in the room, of course, is LGBTQ. And this, of course, is a recent phenomenon. And BYU and other institutions, they're worried that the government will tell them what to do about LGBTQ students, about faculty. And what's interesting in Apostle Jeffrey Holland's speech on Monday to BYU faculty is that Holland averred that there are a number of BYU faculty and students who have become a little too friendly towards the LGBTQ community in recent years, and thought that, in fact, this was really countering some of the church's teachings in LGBTQ issues. And then he said something that, in my opinion, was more of a threat. It certainly wasn't to be taken seriously, which is that if the university has to lose its accreditation in order to stay true to the teachings of the church, so be it. And Holland's a smart man. He knows that you can't run a university, a legitimate university, without accreditation. And so I'm sure, as we speak today, that this puts some BYU faculty members, some of whom are my friends, some of whom have been quite vocal about their expressions of love and affection for their LGBTQ students, I'm sure it puts them in a tough situation, because they're having to do the same thing that Ernest Wilkinson had to do some four decades earlier, which is toe a very difficult line between the federal accreditors and then the board. Well, the faculty today are having to toe a difficult line as well between their students and the board.
Professor Matt Harris, he's writing a book about all of this that will come out next year. He's also author of The Mormon Church and Blacks, A Documentary History. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Elder Holland's speech and the swift and emotional reaction to it. We should say that we reached out to The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints this week, and we invited Elder Holland to join us on the program. A church spokesperson declined our offer, didn't provide a statement for us to read. He just told us that Elder Holland's remarks, as he said, speak for themselves. So let's go through the talk. We're going to begin with the religion scholar Taylor Petrie, who has written about gender studies and Mormonism. He's an associate professor at Kalamazoo College in Michigan.
I think a lot of people were caught off guard by this talk, and I think that there are a number of reasons why it seemed to miss the moment and jar so many people. One reason is that, we sort of are in this moment, cultural moment here, of a broader tension in our culture of polarization, of divisiveness. And in many ways, this talk seemed to kind of throw fuel onto the fire of opposition to BYU, of opposition to maybe more moderate or progressive values, and really gave a lot of ammunition to critics of BYU, of which there are a number in the church, and a growing number, really, of far right wing members of the church.
Who think it's a liberal institution or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And so in many ways, this really gave a lot of oxygen to this internal culture war within the church in a very one-sided way. And so it seemed to really miss the moment for, I think, a lot of people who say, you know, we're facing an era where half of the members of the church don't think that the election was won by Joe Biden, where huge numbers of the church are rejecting vaccinations and mask requirements. And those are the kinds of things that are really on the mind of professors who are about to enter into the classroom at an institution that has not done as much as other institutions and probably not done as much as it could or should on that issue. And so to kind of go back to a culture war issue as being one that, frankly, the church has lost, not only in the broader context, but in many ways among the membership as well, not only at BYU and not certainly among its students, but really in across all demographics in the church, there is an erosion of acceptance of the church's teachings on some of these issues. And to sort of go back to that and harp that as the most important issue that we need to be fighting about, really, I think you're facing, you have a lot of beleaguered faculty who that wasn't the message that they were hoping to get.
Let's talk about who was delivering the message and explain some context about Jeffrey Holland. Holland is thought of by some as more moderate, as more amiable, as less doctrinaire than some of the leadership of the church. So I think for some, this was surprising and in some ways a disappointment. What do you think about that?
Yeah, Elder Holland has been a hero for many decades for intellectual members of the church, certainly for other academics. He's one of the only top-level general authorities to be trained in the humanities. He has an English degree from Yale University. He's close to university politics and ran BYU himself for nearly a decade at a very successful time for the university and was able to kind of manage a lot of the internal tensions that happen on that campus between more conservative and liberal factions and manage that successfully and really kind of win praise on all sides of those issues. And that's a reputation that he has cultivated over many years, where he's been very supportive of scholars and academics and scholarship and BYU, and also has a reputation for being very empathetic, someone who is easily moved to tears, who is deeply feels the emotions of the people who he's talking to. And this talk felt like a rebuke. It felt like a little bit of turning his back away from BYU and from many of the faculty there. He seemed to be hurting by things that he perceived to be happening at BYU, but really inflicted a wound on many at BYU, I think, as a result of this talk, in a way that was a little bit out of step with the reputation that he had developed over the years.
So after a bit of throat clearing, Holland begins by invoking what seems to be the theme of it, of the speech, which is the greatness of the university, the greatness of BYU. You know, he has this impression from when he was young that BYU is, you know, the greatest university in the world. So he goes on to thank, you know, those associated with the school. He thanks teachers and groundskeepers and cooks and staff and students. And then he mentions two different letters he received, one from a teacher at the school who wanted to help students have this, you know, deep and profound experience to be part of what the letter described as this chorus of everlasting joy. But then he mentions another letter or memo, as he described it, that he had received not so long ago. I guess it's a letter, maybe it's an email, but Holland said it was two pages.
You should know, the writer says, that some people in the extended community are feeling abandoned and betrayed at BYU or by BYU. It seems that some professors, at least the vocal ones in the media, are supporting ideas that many of us feel are contradictory to gospel principles, making it appear to be about like any other university our sons and daughters could have attended. Several parents have said they no longer want to send their children here or donate to the school. Please don't think I'm opposed to people thinking differently about policies and ideas, the writer continues. I'm not. But I would hope that BYU professors would be bridging those gaps between faith and intellect and would be sending out students that are ready to do the same in loving, intelligent, articulate ways. Yet I fear that some faculty are not supportive of the church's doctrines and policies and choose to criticize them publicly.
I think that the choice of reading that particular letter really said a lot about where many general authorities' concerns lie, where their sympathies lie. There's a long-standing, set of kind of right-wing critiques of universities and even of BYU that have happened over the years. they taught evolution too explicitly, you know, and they used, general authorities used to get letters about that all the time. Then it was too feminist, and then it was too nice on race issues. And then, and now it's on LGBT issues. There's been a kind of long tradition of conservative critiques of BYU. And so it's interesting to see that Elder Holland is kind of cueing into that tradition. And again, giving it a lot of oxygen and giving it a lot of validity. There really isn't any evidence that BYU professors are undermining the faith of students, that they are, you know, radicalizing the students in some ways against the church, anything along those lines. In fact, I'm quite sure it's the opposite. Latter-day Saint professors at BYU are deeply devoted to the church and model righteous discipleship and with intellectual inquiry to their students all the time, right? And so this kind of, you know, myth that BYU is somehow undermining the church is one that he kind of just lays out as if it's true. There's really, I think, a disconnect between where LDS students and professors are at and actually their commitment to the church and their commitment to making BYU and the church a strong institution. And the kind of, you know, right-wing voices who are just skeptical of professors and skeptical of liberal academia that we see on Fox News and in other outlets, you know, that sort of has seeped into the consciousness of so many, I think, older Latter-day Saints who have, you know, who have kind of given into this. And rather than defend BYU, rather than show that BYU is actually building the faith of students, Elder Holland really kind of gives a lot of credibility to these charges.
Let's talk about this metaphor Holland invokes in a few places. First, it comes from an LDS general authority named Neil A. Maxwell.
In a way, Latter-day Saint scholars at BYU and elsewhere are a little bit like the builders of the temple in Nauvoo, who worked with a trowel in one hand and a musket in the other. Today, scholars building the temple of learning must also pause on occasion to defend the kingdom. I personally think, Elder Maxwell went on to say, this is one of the reasons the Lord established and maintains this university. The dual role of builder and defender is unique and ongoing. I'm grateful we have scholars today who can handle, as it were, both trowel and musket.
Holland also mentioned how Dallin Oaks, now a member of the governing First Presidency of the Church, referenced that metaphor in 2017.
Then Elder Oaks said challengingly, I'd like to hear a little more musket fire from the Temple of Learning.
This is one aspect of the talk that really landed poorly in I think, the contemporary moment, where we see a rise of right-wing violence happening, including in LDS communities, without addressing that, right? And so it's a metaphor, but it's one that, you know, we saw immediately many right-wing members of the church posting pictures of themselves with guns. As a sort of a response to a call to arms, as they saw it here. You know, BYU has long been one of the most important tools, if not the most important tool, for LDS assimilation into broader society. You know, I think that one of the concerns of a kind of antagonistic, of BYU taking an antagonistic relationship to the world, is that it really puts the faculty and the students and the alumni there in a precarious situation where their degrees become a part of that culture war, a part of that battle in ways that they might not be comfortable with necessarily. Elder Oaks before him and Elder Holland here have really tried to call on the faculty to be affirmative defenders of the church's positions explicitly with respect to same-sex marriage. And they have complained about what they call friendly fire, that is, from criticism mm-hmm. from within the church on the church's policies. When Elder Oaks gave his musket fire talk in 2017, it was really in the context of many Latter-day Saints not being supportive of the church's policy from November 2015, made same-sex marriage an act of apostasy and forbade the children of same-sex couples from being baptized, which was widely panned in the LDS community, including at BYU. And Elder Oaks was dissatisfied with that response and called issued a call to arms to BYU to defend the church. A few years later, they abandoned that policy. And I think that many people who did defend the policy at the time regretted stepping out in front of it. And I think that's where a lot of Latter-day Saints are at right now, including those at BYU, of a sort of battle fatigue on this issue. This is an issue that we fought for many decades and lost, and have lost resoundingly. 70% of Americans, including more than 50% of Republicans, support same-sex marriage. This is not a battle that we are going to win by continuing to hammer at the same nail over and over and over again and expecting a different result. And so I think a lot of BYU faculty and students and others, and members of the church in general, are a little just tired of this particular war.
Let me play another moment from Holland's address. This is a moment when he talks about symbols. Tell me what this means.
So it's with a little scar tissue of our own that we are trying to avoid, and hope all will try to avoid, language and symbols and situations that are more divisive than unifying at the time we want to show love for all of God's children.
It's not uncommon on BYU's campus to see pride flags these days. There was a pride parade that was held on BYU's campus this summer. There's a view, I think, among a certain older generation that these are divisive symbols in some way, rather than the way that they're understood by many of the younger generation as being inclusive symbols, as symbols that that show belonging and unity. But an older generation, I think, often interprets these as in the opposite way. And so I think we're really seeing a kind of generational, perhaps a cultural divide on that issue. But he seems very clearly, I think, in the context of the speech overall, to be referencing gay pride paraphernalia and actions and so on, where he wants an expression of love, but not necessarily the symbolism that often accompanies that as a kind of shorthand for that expression.
In this moment, without actually naming him, he calls out a former student at BYU who in 2019, during his valedictory speech, comes out as gay. The student's name is Matt Easton.
If a student commandeers a graduation podium intended to represent everyone getting diplomas that day, in order to announce his personal sexual orientation, what might another speaker feel free to announce the next year until eventually anything goes?
This was, for me, one of the most shocking aspects of the speech. Matt Easton has clarified what many knew beforehand. Valedictory speeches are previewed beforehand, while Elder Holland accused the student of commandeering the speech, of somehow he wasn't authorized to do this in some way when he had previewed the speech beforehand. It had gotten green lighted. And also to interpret the speech as divisive when very few people did that. This speech won national praise. It was covered in the national news as being an example of a new BYU. And, so for Elder Holland to kind of lift that student up, again, that alumnus, that student who was the valedictorian, right, as a bad example of the kind of students that BYU wants to create or the kind of mood that it wants to create, while at the same time reading a letter from somebody who went to BYU in the 1970s, waxing nostalgic about how great it was back then, I think really showed a disconnect for where BYU is at and the culture that has tried to create and where general authorities would like BYU to be at.
So Holland then comes to what seems like the crux of his argument, that BYU is unique, has always been unique, and should remain so.
We could mimic every other university in this world until we get a bloody nose in the effort. And that world would still say, BYU who? No, we must have the will to be different, to stand alone if necessary, being a university second to none in its role primarily as an undergraduate teaching institution that is unequivocally true to the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. If at a future time that mission means foregoing some professional affiliations and certifications, then so be it. There may come a day when the price we are asked to pay for such association is simply too high, too inconsistent with who we are. No one wants it to come to that, least of all me. But if it does, we will pursue our own destiny.
This part of the speech is one of those parts that got some of the most attention, that the church itself, that the school itself seems to be willing to sacrifice these things in the interest of keeping its principles, the way they identify their principles. So break down that part. Explain what you think about that part.
Yeah, BYU, over the course of its nearly 150 years, has really had two missions that they have often very successfully been able to balance. On the one hand, they have attempted to create a place where Latter-day Saints can learn secular knowledge, can gain the skills that they need to be successful in the broader world, far beyond the campus of BYU, to go on to be doctors and lawyers and senators and all other kinds of things that they can do, and to give them the training and the skills to do that. And at the same time, BYU has also been very successful in creating a dedicated class of Latter-day Saints who are not only highly educated and successful in the world, but also committed to the church and committed to orthodoxy. And it's clear that Elder Holland has said that these two simultaneous goals are ones that we both value, but the one that we value the most is creating Orthodox Latter-day Saints. That's why we're putting these billions of dollars into this university, is to create that class of Orthodox Latter-day Saints. And you, faculty, are failing at that goal. And if it ever comes that we have to choose between those two goals, we are going to choose orthodoxy over assimilation, right? We are going to make sure that this is an institution that is producing loyal, faithful Latter-day Saints. The risk of that is really putting that balance, that delicate balance that the church had created between accomplishing these two goals on the line. It's not clear that you can actually accomplish only one of them at BYU. If they were only going for orthodoxy and alienating themselves from the broader world, most Latter-day Saints would probably choose to go to the many other fine universities in the country without all of the extra baggage that comes from being at BYU, especially if it wasn't an accredited institution. He basically said that BYU may become a pariah university at some point, and we're okay with that. And I don't think that there is anything near around the corner by any stretch of the imagination that actually would happen. But to state it as a potential outcome that the church would be open to, really, again, I think puts at risk the value of a BYU degree in the long term. I think it's going to make it harder to recruit faculty. I think it's going to make it harder to recruit students. And I think that alumni are going to be even more reticent than many already are about putting BYU on their CV when they're applying for jobs, if BYU comes to be known principally for this. If this becomes the defining thing that people think of when they think about BYU, it's really going to, I think, be a disaster for the university. But the church says that they are willing to go that direction if they have to. So he really put a pretty fine point on it.
So let me ask you finally, Professor, what happens now, do you think? How will this speech, I guess, change the dynamic of being in the church? I mean, Holland made these veiled references to symbols like rainbow flags, I assume. He mentioned parades, like pride parades, I can only assume. So, you know, will participation in parades, will flying banners and flags, will that now be really conspicuous for members in a way that it wasn't before? Will there be dissent and talk. And I mean, what are you expecting now in that way?
Yeah, I think that it really emboldens conservative critics of moderate and progressive members by giving them kind of one more tool to find fault with those members. You know, we're really seeing a strong retrenchment, especially among conservatives. And, you know, just as we have seen so many times before with, you know, when President Hinckley said that women shouldn't have two piercings, right? This became a kind of cultural marker of how obedient of a Mormon are you. We right. may see that, you know, wearing a pride pin somehow becomes either a subversive or, you know, you're not following the prophet kind of act now, right? So we may see things along those lines. We may see a kind of emboldening again of conservatives who are see other members of the church as insufficiently orthodox. I do think that it contributes to a climate of fear and tension, especially on the BYU campus. There have been various kind of movements of critics of BYU, both inside the institution and from some student groups as well, who are trying to kind of root out liberal factions or liberal faculty, and, you know, we'll write letters about them or go and spy on their classes. And this is a long tradition at BYU, actually going back to Ezra Taft Benson in the 1960s, who had spy rings to find out who the communists were on BYU's campus, right? So we may see a kind of, again, emboldening of those parts of the church who are trying to root out aspects of the church or members of the church or members of the BYU faculty that they see as insufficiently loyal or insufficiently orthodox on some of this issue. And that, again, it contributes to a kind of climate of fear and tension on the campus. I think it also makes it harder for the campus itself to establish some of those goals that it itself has set out around a more loving and inclusive environment. You know, they had just set up this Office of Belonging as one of the tools in their quiver to kind of attempt to deal with this issue, to make BYU a more comfortable place for all of the young Latter-day Saints who go there. And I think that this, you know, is again maybe going to just cause a little bit more division rather than the kind of healing and unity that it might have been intended to apply.
Taylor Petrie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Taylor Petrie, he's author of the book Tabernacles of Clay, Sexuality and Gender in Mormonism. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. We reached out this week to The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to ask them for some comments about a speech delivered by Senior Apostle Jeffrey Holland at BYU on Monday. A church spokesperson declined our offer and our invitation for Holland to join us. Now, of course, the people most disappointed by the speech were queer Latter-day Saints. We talked to Kendall Wilcox and Maddie Hawes to get that perspective. Kendall is a media producer and a participant in the group Mormons Building Bridges. Maddie is a student at BYU and a co-founder of the group BYUQ. Kendall went first.
My first blush reaction was that it was very insulting, particularly where he sort of tried to profess his undying love for LGBT people and concern, but also coupled that with this narrative about how much he and his fellow brethren have shed tears and have these scars, right? He mentioned these emotional scars from having to take the time to sort of wrestle with this queer Mormon conflict. I don't doubt that they have wrestled with it. But for somebody who seems to be so erudite and so emotionally sensitive, to center his emotional response and to say that, oh, no, they have scars. Let's put that in the context of a whole history, right, of countless LGBT people and our allies and the kinds of scars that we have endured to the point of death. Let's just be totally clear, to the point of death. That just was insulting.
Maddie, how did you react?
My gut reaction, honestly, was that I didn't want to read or listen to it at first. I saw he gave a talk, and I just pushed it away. And then multiple of my friends, as well as followers of BYUQ, called and messaged in tears over it. And so I then read it, and I was just not as much disappointed or angry, but kind of heartbroken that it was to come from someone that is Holland, where he's certainly not perfect, but he does seem to be not necessarily an ally, but more expressive of his love over his distrust and distaste of the LGBT community. And it was also, I guess I did feel angry, but not necessarily fully on my behalf, but on the behalf of the faculty that they were seemingly being manipulated and having their jobs held over their heads for just showing love to their students.
I wanted to ask you about the tone of the speech. He was pretty emotional throughout. So what did you think about the tears that came along with this scolding, basically?
Mm-hmm. I mean, tears are his go-to sort of emotional performance. Huh. I don't think it's always disingenuous. I don't.
Yeah.
But there's a line. And again, it's a fuzzy line. I'm not saying I am the expert on it. But when you couple these, you know, professions of love and tears with, you know, violent rhetoric around the metaphorical use of muskets to defend the faith, it just comes off as disingenuous.
Maddie, you used the word manipulative here a moment ago. Is that what you thought?
Yes, I think it was extremely manipulative. Quite honestly, as a queer woman of color, it just reminded me of every time that I expressed my feelings of an uncomfortability in a space because of my sexuality or my ethnicity or my gender. It felt so much like he was just kind of bringing all of that in at once and giving, as Kendall says, giving that performance. He does use tears so often in general conference, and I agree. I think sometimes it is genuine. But I think the tears coupled with talking about how hard it is for parents of straight kids to have to grapple and weep tears over what the LGBT community puts them through, coupling those with his literal tears, I think just doubles down on the performance that was being made.
Again, like it wasn't entirely disingenuous, and I'm not a trained clinical psychologist.
But you have said in some ways he performed his compassion.
Well, yeah. Again, it's you just can't convince me as a gay Latter-day Saint that when you couple the violent rhetoric and the doubling down rhetoric on harmful church teachings about LGBTQ people with this emotion, it doesn't ring true to me and to a lot of people like me. But to me, the tears in this particular speech, to me it betrayed what feels like a growing sense of exhaustion within him and frustration that he has to keep talking about this. He feels obligated to keep talking about this. He even said like he would rather not. He said it
in
the
speech. He did say that. That was interesting.
And I believe him.
But wait, what does that mean? Like, I would rather not keep telling you this thing that you don't seem to be getting, or maybe the thing that we've got isn't exactly right, but I need to keep saying it because I'm in the position I'm in.
Both.
Really?
I'm no expert. This is my perception as having been keenly aware of this for a couple decades, but he just seems tired and frustrated of having to say this. And my perception is that among him and his fellow brethren, that the message that they are trying to sell us on about how to frame this queer Mormon conflict is not resonating. It's not resonating particularly with Gen Z, as he's mentioned it specifically before, according to the data that they are reading.
I want to get into your framing question, but Maddie, I want to give you a chance to respond to that part. What do you think?
I think that his and other general authorities' reiteration, as Kendall says, of Gen Z, the new generation, the young generation, and them befriending, how dare they befriend people that are going against, right? They're showing acceptance rather than just love, but rather than just tolerance, right? I think is showing that they're recognizing the, not necessarily the threat, because threat is such, has such negative connotations with it, but the position that it puts them in because of the power that Gen Z and some millennials hold because of that. And I think they're realizing that, and they don't know what to do with that, especially as they're the ones that have a bigger hold on social media. And that's many of the times how people that are outside of the church are hearing about church news, is because of social media, what people are putting on their Instagram stories. That's how non-members are hearing from their member friends. And so when Gen Z and millennials are the ones that have more of that power and more of that following there, rather than in an every Sunday sacrament meeting in the chapel, they're realizing that they might not hold the same power in all the same formats and mediums, and that they need to figure out how to take control back.
So, Kendall, you've talked about the way Elder Holland is framing this conflict for members of the church, that he's somehow found a way to sort of, on one hand, justify the church's position, but make it seem, I don't know, palatable, loving.
Right. Okay. And it's not just him, of course. You know, it's all of his brethren. They have landed on a messaging around this queer Mormon conflict that, again, yeah, that helps Latter-day Saints, in their estimation, and for themselves, I would imagine, feel justified in their, you know, condemning and excluding LGBT people and our love and our gender expressions. It helps them justify it. But they've framed it in a way where they say, you know, in President Oakes's terms, there is love that we should show, but there is the law. And love cannot break the law, you know. And in the way that Elder Holland expresses it, that love or compassion or empathy should never flow over into the arena of advocacy or condoning, right? Or enabling is really what he's saying, enabling sin.
I 100% believe that the love the sinner, hate the sin is being used and is harmful rhetoric, and it's not okay, as so many have pointed out, but so many continue to use it. And also, the church has the opportunity every single day to be condemning racists in the church or alt-right groups that are quite literally threatening to use and point guns, taking Holland's words literally, and yet they choose to condemn people that are simply asking to be treated with love. And it's not a threat to be asked to be treated with love. So the fact that they are choosing to condemn our this community over the communities that are spewing hate, the exact opposite of what Christ would want, shows and speaks a lot to what the brethren are wanting to do at this point in time.
Let me play a moment from Holland's speech on Monday.
Let me go no farther before declaring unequivocally my love and that of my brethren for those who live with this same-sex challenge and so much complexity that goes with it.
Okay, he said same-sex challenge. What does that tell you about the way the church is thinking of, you know, queer members and the reality of homosexuality and gender identity? Maddie, you first.
I can't speak to what the church is saying. All I can truly think of it is that queer people are not the ones with the issues here. We're not the ones with the challenges and the issues. I'm not challenged by my sexuality and knowing whether or not I'm a child of God or if I deserve worth. I'm not challenged by that based on what I'm feeling in my heart. I'm challenged by that based on what is being told to me and what I'm being told to be thinking.
Maddie, what do you think it's going to be like now being a queer Latter-day Saint and a student at BYU? What's it going to be like now, do you think? How's this going to maybe change what it's like to be on campus?
As a queer Latter-day Saint, quite honestly, I'm not quite sure. Because as a member of the church, Monday's talk wasn't too surprising, or it was hurtful, but not as much as it would have been if it had been like the first we were hearing of that. I think it has affected me more as a queer BYU student, and that I have no idea what professors should turn to at this point. Like, one of my things I did with BYUQ last year is I made a safe faculty directory. I asked queer and trusted ally students of the professors they've had that have declared themselves as an ally, have their pride flags, have their pride pins. And then I contacted, emailed every single one of the professors, explained the purpose of BYUQ, explained how important it is that people have a safe place to learn. And I formed this directory. And at this point, it has at least 70 faculty and professors on it. And after Holland's talk, I took that down from our website because we need to protect those professors. Mm. And because at this point, I don't even know what those professors are allowed to do. I don't know what this means for professors. I don't know if professors need to take down their rainbow flags from their offices or take down their all are welcome here in rainbow font signs on their doors. I don't know what any of this means. And I'm sure that's terrifying for the professors. And it's even more terrifying for the students because professors that maybe know all of our life story or have seen us in our with our rainbow pins or saw us dress up on Rainbow Day. We don't know what that means, if they can still be trusted. And I know some professors have said that what Holland said is not going to change what they do, but and I want to believe them as much as I can, and some of them I do, but I don't know how administration will respond to them, so I don't know what that means for us in the long run or those professors in the long run.
Elder Holland in his speech did mention his and other leaders, as he put it, unequivocal love. He acknowledged the cruelty of the world, he said. He said that he had wept and leaders had prayed with LGBTQ people. Now, if he's saying what he actually did say in that speech, how much does that love count? Maddie, you first.
Love is not a word or a claim. I am under the firm belief that love is an action. We talk so much about the Savior's undying love for the world, which he showed by offering his life for us, which was an action. That's how we talk about his love, in action. And so I think Elder Holland saying we unequivocally love our LGBT siblings and BYU students and believers, I don't think it means anything when they're not able to actually show that. And they're not doing anything to make me or many other people feel that. Much like when you apologize to someone and you say sorry. It doesn't truly mean anything until you show that you're sorry or that you're not going to do that again.
100% agree. A big part of me wants to take him at his word, right? Treat him as a fellow human being who's trying. And so I wrestle with that, honestly. And at the same time, knowing just how absolutely harmful the LDS Church teachings are for LGBT people, any offers of love or protestations of love, unequivocal and undying as they may be, and coupled with tears, that are also coupled with a doubling down on these harmful LDS Church teachings on LGBT people rings hollow to me. Because, exactly as Maddie said, those kinds of offers of love have no function in my life. They have no meaning. They don't help me. They don't nurture my health and wholeness because, again, they're coupled with a belief that when I experience love for a man, that's actually just Satan deep inside of me, tainting all those positive experiences and feelings and emotions. That's actually Satan. You just cannot convince me that that is love. And so, and to me, it's a manifestation of the kind of moral sickness that he and fellow members of the church are laboring under, and that I have labored under for decades of my life, as I have chosen intentionally, openly, consciously, to frame myself and my lived experience under that same belief, that same moral sickness of believing that same-sex love or transgender expressions are Satan's manifestation and Satan's temptation. And I've seen how that moral sickness has corroded my soul on so many levels. And I feel like I see that in fellow members of the church who choose to subscribe to it, or, you know, Elder Holland himself. And that's where I can come at him with some compassion and empathy while still totally holding him accountable, standing my ground, speaking my truth about it, but understanding that, yeah, he's laboring under this space of this moral sickness that it's genuinely corroding his soul. And I feel like, again, this is just my projection, but You can see it in his face. You can see it in his body. You can see it in his voice, in the tone of his voice. It's corrosive, and it always will be until we eradicate it from the Mormon experience.
Kendall Wilcox is a media producer. He participates in the Mormons Building Bridges community. He's on Twitter, at Kendall Wilcox. Maddie Haas is a sophomore at BYU, also co-founder of the on-campus advocacy group BYUQ. Her Twitter handle is at Maddie Haas. You can find links to their accounts and more information on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, we'd love to hear from you. We're also on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.